Well, anyone could have written a biography of Jesus, anyone interested to do so, but only a lover could write a gospel. And they all, each in their own way, take us into that mystery of Jesus' person. This is especially true of John, who you're watching in that icon. He is trying to, as best one can, express in words what he discovered there at the Last Supper, at the foot of the cross, and throughout the public ministry of Jesus. The disciples were often asking, who is he? Who is this extraordinary person? What impressed them most, of course, was his love. And it was his love that healed, and it was his love that inspired his actions. It was his love that revealed itself in the wonderful parables that he spoke. But he's actually never revealing himself. He's always revealing the one he called Abba, God. So when they kept asking this question, obviously the answer they came up with was that the mystery of Jesus, who he really is, who is this one, could only be found by watching him pray, by listening to what came out of his communion with God. That was the key to his person, obviously. At the Last Supper, with a broken heart, Jesus said, "You'll be scattered, each one to his home, and you'll leave me alone." But he went straight on to add, "But I'm never alone. The Father is with me." That's the secret of Jesus. "I'm never alone," he said. "The Father is with me." That extraordinary piece of bronze sculpture there you're watching is, if you look inside, you see Jesus dying on the cross, don't you? But if you look at the outside, this same Jesus, while he's dying, my God, why have you abandoned me?" At the same time, he's trusting, believing, hoping, knowing in faith, of course, knowing that his Father is with him. So into your hands I commend my spirit. It's all done in the one work of art there. At the heart of Jesus' disciples' attraction to him was their experience of his special experience with God. And again we hear the Gospels telling us about Jesus' prayer, and I'll take you just through a memory journey, because you all know these texts, but just to reflect on them. And what we're looking for is, who is Jesus and what he reveals about God and therefore about us? At the baptism, we're told, when he came up out of the water, something happened to Jesus clearly at the baptism. Because after that, after he went away to try and cope with the experience and depth it and wonder about it, he became the preacher, the lover, the healer, the missionary, all that we see him in the Gospels. Prior to that, we actually know nothing about him except the name of his mother, his father, and where he came from in Nazareth. That's it. So something extraordinary happened to Jesus. And when the disciples talked about it, thought about it, talked to him about it, no doubt, the best they could do, and I'm giving you this account from Mark here, it's supposed to be Peter's gospel, traditionally, the Gospel of Mark. So Peter or someone in the community, then Peter got it and expressed it to Mark, and now Mark gives it to you. What they do is, they just go back over their poetry, their Old Testament literature, and they try to gather together the music and the poetry and the implications and the rhythms of the Old Testament. That's their language, so that's all they've got to use. So they put it together in this extraordinarily brief but wonderful scene. We're told, well, first of all, the heavens were torn apart, and that might take you back, if you know, the prayer of the disciples of Isaiah, who prayed, "Tear the heavens open, come down, God, we need you here." And Peter, Mark, sees the baptism of Jesus as the answer to that prayer. The heavens were torn apart, and God reveals himself now in the man Jesus. And a voice came from heaven. Now, if you had a tape recorder there, you wouldn't have picked this up, surely. And Jesus didn't hear it with his ears. This is the experience expressed in the wonderful words that come from one of the servant songs of Isaiah. "You are my son, the one I love. With you I am well pleased. All my soul delights in you." So the experience of Jesus at the baptism was one of love. Now, it wasn't his first time he experienced love of God, clearly. But you can be loved and then loved and then loved. I mean, it's not a quantitative thing. This was an overwhelming experience of love. And when Jesus went into the desert to live with this experience and somehow work through it and see its implications, what we're doing on retreat really, of revelation, he came to see clearly that what he experienced at the baptism was true of everybody. If only they knew. If only they knew. So then his whole ministry flows from this experience. He comes to see that what Mary of Magdala didn't know but needed to know, what the thief on the cross didn't know but needed to know, what Peter needed to know, what the leper needed to know, that get through all the whole gospel, and what we need to know, is how loved we are. That's the secret. And Jesus, knowing it, looked into the eyes of all these people through his 3 years or whatever of ministry, and he saw how loved they were. And because he saw it, some of them saw it too, reflected in his eyes and smile and words and embrace and so on. So this experience of the baptism is a key to his ministry, because it's a key to his inner life and who he really is. I'll read you from Mark, chapter 1, verse 35, and the following. He says it, he could have said this every day, but he says it here. "In the morning, while it was still very dark, Jesus got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed." In the early years of my ministry, when I, like all you, and I won't say you were too busy, I might have been teaching, and you can imagine what life is like. Very busy, and I was praying, all right. I was praying on the run, mostly. And then that happens every now and then, too. But it keeps dawning on me, I presume it dawns on you. God, if Jesus needed to stop doing things and go away and be on his own and pray, do you think I need to do it? You're allowed to nod. Do you think you need to do it? Do you think we need to do it? I mean, if Jesus needed it, God help us. So here it is. He's had a very busy day. He's been healing people. He loved doing what he was doing. People loved him. And there's queues of people, we're told, lined up to be healed and loved. And who doesn't want love? So, and then the boys go to bed and close the door and try and keep the mob out. And then Jesus got up, quietly, obviously, went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. Simon and his companions hunted for him, because he's banging on the blooming door of the next lot of people who wanted to be healed. So Simon said, and they find the bit of mat that Jesus was on. Isn't there? Where the hell is he? He's always getting away. So off they go, they're hunting for him. They found him, and they said to him, "Everyone's searching for you." Wouldn't that be a nice feeling, do you reckon? Like if I left a parish and heard that everybody in the parish was wanting me, you'd feel pretty good about that. And if you went home and all your kids just wanted you home, you'd feel good too. And all your neighbours and everyone at work. I mean, we like being welcomed, of course we do. And they said, look, everyone's searching for you. And if you thought everyone was searching for you, if I thought it, I'd probably go back to be where I'm loved. It's pretty natural. But Jesus didn't. Let's go on to the neighbouring towns so that I may proclaim the message there, because that is why I was sent. What was he praying about all night? He was praying about, you can guess it as easy as I can, what do you want me to do? My Father is always with me. I always do what pleases him. He's just trying to discern the will of God. He could have stayed in Capernaum for the rest of his ministry and never had a spare day. But he must have discerned. He did discern in prayer. God wanted him to go on. And that would have broken his heart too, because he can still see the eyes of the people who are waiting for him back there. And he's not going to go back there now. He's going to go on. So something God is revealing to him in the silence, what God wants him to do and to be. Luke tells us that many crowds would gather to hear Jesus and be cured of their disease, of course. But, says Luke, he would withdraw to deserted places and pray. Pray, be in communion with the Abba, God. Before selecting the 12 disciples, and what a wonderful choice he made. And the choice included Judas, all right. So Judas must have had wonderful capacity for leadership and understanding and courage and all the rest of needed. And Jesus probably thought, I've got to have this fellow in the group. So he's good. It was very sad towards the end. We won't talk about here particularly, but towards the end, Judas lost patience with Jesus. He was too soft, for God's sake. And they needed to oppose the Romans. They needed to oppose the temple. They needed to get out there and demonstrate. And here's Jesus forgiving people and telling the woman in adultery, don't sin again, but look, I'm not going to condemn you. And too soft for Judas, apparently. So Judas tried to bring on the clash because he knew who'd win. He knew Jesus would win, that's obvious. Now, Jesus didn't win, not at the level that he was thinking. And that's when he broke down and threw the money back, and poor man despaired. But gee, it's hard to believe that when the one who hugged him in the garden and called him friend, he couldn't have forgot that. So we can pray and hope and be pretty sure that Judas is having a wonderful time in heaven. When people break down enough to take their life, God must be just weeping with love for them. So before he selected the 12 disciples, Jesus went out to the mountain to pray and spent the whole night in prayer. He chose very well, but we human beings can fail. A wonderful statement this is. It's found in Luke and Matthew. I think we've got Matthew to thank for a lot of these phrases, because Matthew, one of the Gospels, is even named after Matthew. So my guess is that Mark wrote the Gospel from Peter, the storyline, but they didn't have available to them. But Matthew had copied, like the way you people are doing now, copied down all the words anyhow and got it all. And then, so the community in Antioch had available to them all the sayings of Jesus, that dear Matthew. So that's probably why they called it the Gospel of Matthew, adding into Mark. And Luke pinched it too and used it, of course. Well, you listen to this. At that time, Jesus rejoiced in the Holy Spirit. And he said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you've hidden these things from the wise and intelligent. Well, God isn't hiding them. The veil is over their eyes, of course. People are hiding away from them, but there it is, the wise, inverted commas, and intelligent aren't getting it, aren't seeing it. But you've revealed them to infants, little tiny children who haven't yet learned to speak. That's what an infant is. So it's quite obvious to a baby. But us intelligent and well-educated people can become too smart to see it, apparently, sadly. You've revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father. No one knows who the Son is except the Father. No one knows who you are except the people who love you. Because you can't know without love. Well, no one can know the Son really. Only the Father knows him so intimately. And no one knows who the Father is except the Son and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal. And he chooses to reveal the Father to anyone willing to look and listen. Another scene which I touched on this morning briefly is that transfiguration. You're looking at a rather distorted image there. That's Raphael's lovely painting. If ever you go to Rome and go to the art gallery in the Roman, what do you call it? Give us the word. Where you're at. Museum, yeah, museum. And you go to the art part. Do what I've been to Rome 5 times, I think, to do study. And only on the 5th time was it able to be entered. I went there a year, and then I'd go 10 years later, I'd go in again, and it was always closed for renewal. But in that place, in St. Peter's Cathedral, Peter's Basilica, there is a mosaic of this painting, and that's stunningly beautiful. But when you go and see the actual painting, you must do it. You'll be overwhelmed by the beauty of the painting. And it's got, there's a little bit of it, Jesus with Elijah and Moses, the law and the prophets, the Old Testament, hope and longing all there. And at the end, they just said, he's in prayer, Jesus. And that's their way of picturing the prayer. At the end, they saw no one but only Jesus. We don't need any more. And any more we might happen to get, we need to know through his eyes or we won't get it right. Like the Old Testament, for example. If you read the Jewish scriptures and know them really well and don't look at them through Jesus' eyes, you'll end up doing what the scribes did to Jesus. You'll crucify him. You'll get caught up in a locked-in view because they didn't know Jesus. How could they? Luke records that on one occasion the disciples, seeing Jesus at prayer, said, Lord, teach us to pray. They'd been taught by their parents, and John the Baptist, but they never prayed this way. So they obviously wanted what you want and I want. They wanted to learn from Jesus how to pray. And he spoke of God as their Father, and that's the Our Father. They wanted to share the kind of intimacy with God that was so apparent in Jesus. That's what you want and what I want. This is what he calls eternal life. That's what that means. It was this special relationship that fascinated Jesus' disciples and more than anything that attracted them to him. They didn't know at first, but they gradually depthed it. And then came the crucifixion, which shattered everything. And then the resurrection, which brought it all to an astonishing kind of coming together. It was Jesus' special relationship with God that scandalized the religious leaders. In fact, they claimed he was calling God up, and they said, oh, you're making yourself equal with God. And Jesus says, what are you talking about? He says, I'm not equal with God, I only do my Father's will. And he goes on to describe who he is, the Son of God, the one whose life comes from God. But he's not claiming equality with God, for heaven's sake. I always do what pleases him. I only do what my Father tells me, he says, in response. Everything Jesus said or did came from this special communion with God. So as we're watching Jesus this morning, tomorrow we'll move on to see his mission, but as we watch him, that's what we're coming to. John writes, the Father loves the Son and has placed everything in his hands. His special communion didn't protect him from the suffering that is part of the human experience. It never does. God's love doesn't protect us from many things, but it helps us go through them and respond in love. Special communion sustained Jesus. And the fruit of this communion was a loving that his disciples had never previously experienced, a love for them, indeed a love for the world, that flowed from this communion he had with God. There's a wonderful, I think, Father Pat O'Carrigan is a missionary of the Sacred Heart, died quite a few years ago now, and he did many paintings of the Stations of the Cross, and this is from one of them, and I find it quite beautiful, really. There's Jesus in the agony, anguished prayer, which you know. He's praying, he wants to do God's will, of course, but how do you explain the agony? Oh, you can't explain it, but what was going on in Jesus, we're not really told, but we can pretty well find our way into it a bit with prayer, I think. I'm assuming he must have felt a failure. He hadn't carried out God's will, because no one's changed much. Pharisees are the same, the Sadducees are the same, the scribes are the same, the Romans are the same, the crowd is as fickle as ever. There are some wonderful people who've listened, but God, only not too many handfuls. So he might well have felt, when everything's gathering, all the vultures are gathering, he might well have felt he'd done something wrong or hadn't done enough or had gone too quickly. I don't know what he was thinking. But he eventually comes to that beautiful place that we're all going to come to, where he says, Father, you know what I want. I want more time. I want to love more. I want more space. I want all this because that's what you sent me to do. And so the people that live and live to the full, and they're not yet living to the full, so my mission isn't finished yet. So I want more time to do it. That's a fair prayer. But I want what you want. And please don't think God wanted Jesus to die on a cross. That'll muck up the whole thing. God wanted Jesus to love. And so Jesus comes to that strong point where he knows, I will do my Father's will, whatever happens. I'll keep embracing lepers, I'll keep eating with sinners, I'll keep putting a mirror up to the religious institution to show how failing it is. I'll keep doing your will, whatever comes. And whatever came, sadly, is crucifixion. Pilate didn't listen, Herod didn't listen. The high priest didn't listen, the crowd didn't listen, so this beautiful Jesus was killed sinfully by human injustice and just blindness. But the beauty of what happened on Calvary, please don't think God's on the side of the people hammering in the nails. God, if you want to see where God is, you've got to look for love. And when you find love, you find God. And you find love, of course, with Mary, the mother, and the beloved disciple, and Mary of Magdala, and the crowd that some of them beat their breast, and dear old Simon helped Jesus, and Veronica. You know the stories. So there's love everywhere, bits of it. But the real love is Jesus. Even the dreadful crucifixion that he knew was against the Father's will, and that he knew was sinful, even that he could still love, and he did. So he cried, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" He feels the depth of that as man, but because of his trust, belief in, trust in, hope in, communion with God, he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." It's another one of Pat O'Carrigan's paintings of the pierced heart of Jesus. And from the very beginning of the church, they've looked on that as the blood and water, the blood of the Eucharist, the water of baptism, as the life of the Spirit, Jesus' Spirit, entering into the community, the church, the mother and the beloved disciple, symbolizing the church. So let me spend a few moments with you on the wonder of our teaching about the Blessed Trinity. You're looking at an icon there by Rublev, 1400 and something, the beginning of the 15th century. And the sun is there in the middle. You know that because of the blue of the sky and the brown of the earth, the divinity and humanity. And though you can't see it too well there because of the clarity, he's looking straight across at the Father, and that's the Father in gold, that's God, whom he called Abba. And he wanted to do God's will, so he's looking to the Father. The Father is looking straight across at the Spirit. Again, the blue of heaven, but the light green of the spring, new life. And the Spirit is looking down at the Eucharist and inviting each of us to this part of the table here. We're welcome there. There. Once years ago, and I won't go into this at any particular length, but I was a chaplain at the University of New South Wales, and a gardener came in, and I've told this story often because I can't forget it, it was so wonderful. The gardener came in, and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I remember that, it was hot, it was summer, and I had a meat pie in here trying to be digested, but that's not irrelevant to the story, because the knock on the door came at 2 o'clock, can you imagine? And he said, "Dan, what's all this about the Trinity?" And I used to like to go down to Watson's Bay Pub, if you know Sydney, and look out across the harbour. A friend of mine said, "It's better than anything you'll see in the Greek Isles." Well, it is if you've got nice young people around you and your red wine or white wine or beer, whatever you like, and you're looking out over the moon reflected off the harbour. Well, I could talk about the Trinity all night in that environment, because it's quite poetic and marvellous. But 2 o'clock on a hot afternoon with a pie and you're trying to be digested with no meat in the pie probably, that's something else. So I, for once in my life, I said, "What do you think about it?" God, I'm glad I asked that. Because he shoved his fork and his thing in the neck. He said, "Well," he said, and he sat down and he talked. I reckon he went for 40 minutes, might have been an hour. It was a heck of a long time. And I'm sitting there, please believe me, silent. But I must have been so entranced by what he was saying. You know, I mean, priest was the best theology lesson I've ever got from this gardener fella. And at the end, he got up and said, "Thanks, Father," and walked out. So, a very wise man. All I could have done was water it down. He finished. He could see that I was amazed by it. So now I'm about to amaze you. But I'm going to do in 2 minutes what he did in 40. He was an artist, guitarist, as I found out. And he said, I look at God the Father as a dance. A dance. Buy a book on dancing and try. You know, the tango. Get a broom. It doesn't work. you're reading how to do it, but what is the dance? I mean, well, God the Son, he saw as the dancer. He showed us the dance. Oh yeah, now I'm getting it a bit. Dance. And the Spirit is the dancing. Because if you read what a dance is, you still can't do it. If you watch someone do it, you think, oh, that's what it is. But you've got to be dragged onto the floor and do the steps. Then you know in your body what it is. The dancing helps you understand the dance. Now let's get a bit another. The song, God is the song. But what is a song unless you've got a singer? And unless you are singing, then you get into it. And let's be more traditional for a moment. God is love, we're told. But what is love? Well, you need a lover to show you, show me, and it's the loving. That's where we start, as little children with our parents. It's the loving of the community that invites people of the church, which we'll come to not today, but later. It's the loving that we experience in the church, is why it's so important, that points us to the lover, Jesus, that is a revelation of love. The Catechism tells us the mystery of the Most Holy Trinity is the most fundamental and essential teaching in the hierarchy of the truths of faith. Our theology isn't a level playing field. There's, I think, concentric circles. There's an inner circle of truths that if you don't believe them, if I don't believe them, well, we can't call ourselves Christian. And right in the heart of it is the doctrine of the Trinity, as long as it's understood properly and you haven't got three gods in your head. But one God revealed in word and in spirit, and the outer word and the inner spirit coming together and into communion with the one God, the one Jesus called Abba. So, knowing that God is spirit, if I really believe that God is spirit, reminds us to be attentive to the divinely inspired movements of our own heart. Movements of longing as we yearn for closer communion with God, whose spirit inspires us. Movements of wonder and praise as we rejoice in God being with us. And it reminds us to be sensitive to these movements in every man and every woman. So that what's coming, what's happening in the heart is critical, of course, and we have to be so sensitive to it, to listen, hear, and there, because we believe that God is spirit. Knowing that God is word reminds us to be attentive to the words and actions through which God speaks to us, and the words and actions through which we respond to God. We learn too to reverence the sacred ground of each person's spirit, and be attentive to each person's word, not always, not simply what they're saying, but what they're actually saying, listening for that. As together we journey towards God, who is the source, the Abba, the Imma, Father, Mother of all. Knowing that God is Father, and Mother is of course equally good, because there's no gender in God. So nurturer, life-giver. In fact, you need both to get God right. And with all our male language, there's a terrible danger, not only a danger, a fact of distortion. And that has its effect right through the organisation of the church, of course. Calling God Father is beautiful so long as we call God Mother as much and realise they're both needed to image the wonder of God. Well, to know that God is Father, Mother, reminds us to open our hearts to God's love and to treat every other person as our brother or sister. I'll conclude with this and then offer you a hymn, a piece of music again. There's Jesus' words in John. This is the secret of who Jesus is. This is what we all want to come to know. This is what prayer is. I am in the Father, and you are in me, and I am in you. That says it all. Jesus is in the Father, in love, believing. And if Jesus is in the Father, and we're in him, and he in us, then we are in the Father. A bit later, John says, or Jesus says in John's Gospel, I pray that they will be one as we are one. He's not talking about ecumenism primarily, that is a very important corollary to it. What he's talking about is one. He wants each disciple to be one with him and with God. I pray that they will be one in me as we are one, Father, with me in them and you in me.